the images of women that you have online, it's advertisement. It's very young women, very bright, very white. So it's also very difficult to generate women of color or women with different body shapes. And what I miss is if we use these models to predict the future or to use for future visions or analysis, we reproduce this gender bias, we reproduce the patriarchy, and we will reproduce the images that we produced in the past.
Hello and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast, brought to you by the Vienna Business Agency. My name is Severin Matusek, and today's guest is Claudia Larcher. Claudia is an artist, filmmaker, and AI researcher who works with video animation, collage, photography, and installations. We met at her studio in Vienna to talk about her most recent work, AI and the Art of Historical Reinterpretation, a growing fictional image archive that injects inclusive and diverse representations into historic images, manipulates future AI training data as a form of activism, and poses important questions on how biases and discrimination are coded into the creation of history, reality, and AI models.
Well, I think there were many reasons to come up with that work. So first, one reason was my research with AI. AI affecting art, affecting society. Then the fact as growing up as a woman. So you realize that you never fit in. You get treated differently. In the last 15 years, I was really working a lot with architecture, the surrounding around us, but also the built architecture that surrounds us here in the apartment, or we look out in Vienna. We have buildings from a lot of different centuries existing next to each other. But these built environments are actually built by men, by white men, and this is actually quite similar to how AI is built, because it got also developed mainly in the Silicon Valley by white males. So there is this kind of bias. So in the built environment, maybe you realize it that some things are out of reach, that your head is not fitting in the surrounding. And in AI, it's the reproduction of bias that is quite visible and that kind of never got fixed.
Mm-hmm. I love the analogy between the physical built environment and the architecture and the virtual worlds that are built by certain people and with certain biases and built-in values. I think it's quite obvious with the example of like height that sometimes you don't fit through a door or something is way too big or way too small. Can you give an example of how such a bias is built in into an AI model, for example, that people use all the time nowadays?
One bias that I realized producing the work was that it's not that easy to generate female faces or women in general. You don't think about it. But the AI models, because I used several ones, I mainly used for this project models from OpenAI or Adobe. Mm-hmm. So they are regulated. Somehow they tried to implement these mitigation filters because I wanted to have the bias in these already regulated systems. Mm-hmm. So OpenAI says, okay, we get rid of biases, but they don't go to the root. They just use filters. So what happened when you generate women is if you use prompts like female or because I generated a diverse collection of women, like Asian, or you want to redress them with tights. These are all kind of trigger words for the AI system, so you get censored. Mm-hmm. And not because the prompts are not right, but what is wrong is that the AI model generates images that get censored by the system. So you don't even see the outputs, but you just get censored in general. Mm-hmm. So I assume that because AI models are so much trained on porn and these over-sexualized images. Mm-hmm. AI reproduces these images you shouldn't see.
So that means that through those millions of images that AI models are being trained on, a lot of the images that it's trained on, female faces and female bodies, come from porn?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it basically takes what's available on the internet and puts it into
a model. It's really like this data scraping online. Yeah. And what we have online, it's not even images. It's also chats. Mm. So imagine Twitter or all these evil chats, I would say. And they are a basis for training AI models. It's just a disaster. Mm. And yeah, also the images of women that you have online, it's advertisement. Mm. It's very young women, very bright, very white. So it's also very difficult to generate women of color or women with different body shapes. Mm. And what I miss is if we use these models to predict the future or to use for future visions or analysis, we reproduce this gender bias, we reproduce the patriarchy, and we will reproduce the images that we produced in the past. So there's nothing very innovative about that.
And did you discover this by accident, by just playing around with AI models, that you realized, okay, there is this bias, there is this difficulty of generating realistic images of women, or it's much harder than images of men, and that led you to the idea for this artwork, or was there another genesis of the artwork?
Basically, 2022, I did a workshop in San Francisco, and in the research, I realized that there also was a lot of work done in art that addressed these biases. I'm a big fan of Kate Crawford, who wrote The Atlas of AI, and she and Trevor Paglen did this work where they analyzed this image data net that had really badly labeled images that had the effect that the outcome was not very nice. And because companies like OpenAI said, well, we had the problem in the past, but we kind of solved it because they used this mitigation filter since summer 2022. But during the workshop where we were like also generating stuff, we just realized that it's not true, that we still have these problems. So you don't have the problem that you can generate porn, but you have the problem that you cannot generate women at all. So it's a bit weird. And when I give a talk or I do a workshop, which I did in the last 2 or 3 years, I was working on this topic of gender bias, I always use the same prompts with the same systems just to see if they improved. They got a bit better, but they didn't really improve that well. This is what concerns me.
And just for context, the mitigation filter that you mentioned, that's basically the solution of the software companies to correct that bias, but it doesn't really work.
I mean, what they do is they use a different prompt. So what you prompt is not the prompt that the model gets to create something new. They really implement or change the prompt and add diversity, more women and stuff like that to it. A colleague of mine told me that he did experiments and he asked AI, after he gave it a prompt, in that case it was OpenAI, a prompt to generate an image. It generated an image and then he asked, what prompt did you use to generate this image? And then the prompt, his existing prompt and the prompt from the model were not the same anymore.
Okay.
So you really can figure out what they add.
So it's basically you're entering a term into a search engine and then realize the search engine replaced your term with something else.
Yes.
Okay.
And which is also problematic.
It's kind of problematic, yes. So the way I look at the artwork is that you also worked a lot with photography before, I think, and you know, in photographic history, I think we always have this idea of photography or the image as something as like a true objective representation. But, you know, looking at history, we know it hasn't been true from the beginning. People have always manipulated images, and there has always been a bias in image making depending on who the person is behind the camera, who arranges the pictures, and so on. So in that sense, I agree that I also don't look at the image as that the image itself and the manipulation of the image is the thing itself, but like, or is the most important part of this artwork. It's more about the AI model and the training set. So would you say that the idea is by creating these images with different characters, different representations, different bodies, that these images then find a way into new AI models that then take these images as their database, and that allows for a more balanced representation of diverse participants.
Exactly. So, I mean, my data set is much too small. I have around 300 pictures. Mm-hmm. For AI model training, you use millions of data. So, I mean, I spread the images already online. So the idea was that somebody accidentally gets them.
Yeah.
And hopefully implements it. And because it's not totally synthetic image, because I really try to change as few as possible. Mm-hmm. If you put it into Google Image Search, still realized as a real image, or you also can find the source file. Mm-hmm. So because there is also this theory of data collapse of AI models if they get overfitted by synthetic images.
Yeah, so if the AI reproduces itself and basically then decreases in...
Exactly, and gets more and more stupid. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as history is kind of a construction of...
Yeah.
It's subjectively constructed, which is also the fact with AI model training, because it gets labeled by people. So what I see in a picture is different. You would probably label a picture differently like I would.
Mm. But that's what I'm interested in as well, in like the bigger context of power relations and history writing, because I agree, we all know that how we frame history and who writes history and what sides and what perspectives are getting promoted is very much biased and subjective and political in many ways. So would you say that this project is also a very political project in a way that it tries to balance out inequalities that have existed in the past and that still exist today, and almost in an activist way tries to influence maybe history or writing or perspectives by channeling those images into the internet or into exhibitions or into people's minds even?
Yes, that was basically the main idea. Mm-hmm. Also to raise awareness, because me as an artist, I cannot change these things. So to raise awareness, also to empower people. So I already got the feedback that people really feel empowered by these images, that they also imagine a future based on these images. Very optimistic. I mean, after the US elections, we see that we kind of go back in history as a society, and it was not able to have a female person of color as president in the US. So this is actually something that should support the idea and also to think about it.
How do you see an artwork like this influencing actual AI models? I think you said like the scale is way too small, like it would need to be millions of images. Could it be that a movement is created where thousands of people create these images in order to influence or manipulate AI systems in a way? Is that a possible future?
This is absolutely possible. It was also a part of the workshop, one workshop I did, that people were like motivated to produce images, how they would like to have the future, and to really produce diverse images, also to have in mind that they probably get used for AI model training. Essential is really like raising awareness, showing the people how to use this technology. Because I teach at art universities. I also do workshops for community centers, work with kids. So the idea is really to reflect on the models that are already implemented in our technology, in our smartphones, in our computers. I mean, everybody uses AI unconsciously, I guess. So to realize what's behind the technology and also to criticize it. Or the better thing would be to use it for a better. Because there are so many negative things happening with AI now that I try to focus on the positive things. Because you can also or train an AI on a complete new mindset and use that.
Yeah, that fear and that negativity in relationship to AI is something I was also curious to talk about with you, because I feel like there's a lot of fear out there, especially with creative people and artists, that are kind of scared of AI as that technology that's going to replace them or that's, you know, make them obsolete. And you worked with AI now for several years and you use it more as a as a tool and as a platform for critical thinking and critical activism in a way. So what would you say, how has your personal relationship to AI evolved as a sort of technology that's both frightening and at the same time opens a lot of new opportunities?
I mean, of course, I was afraid in the beginning. Mm. And then I decided, well, I want to know more about the technology and realized that what I'm afraid of is more the people who own the technology, mm. but not the technology itself, because it can do a lot of good things as well. I think you don't lose your job to AI. You will lose in the creative industry your job to people who work with AI. Mm. And really to learn these tools, it's really crucial, I guess. So, and I also understand that if people invested a lot of money in their studies and now they are in their 40s or 50s and that they're really afraid or maybe also overwhelmed by the idea that they have to relearn or change their profession. Mm. I totally understand that. But AI models get implemented in all kinds of softwares now. It's much easier to use AI now than it was 2 years ago, for example. So I think it's getting easier and it takes away a lot of tasks that I actually didn't like to do a lot.
Yeah.
So it's really supportive. We as a society have to be somehow careful how we use that tool and for which companies we work for. If you work for a company who says, well, I can keep on doing my stuff with half of the people and I get rid of them and AI will get the job, I don't think that these companies should be supported by society. Or that we think about a tax system, that companies who use AI a lot just pay taxes on that. So we have a general income for people who will lose their jobs. So this is all, it's really about the society we live in and in which society we want to live in. We have to choose the politicians that support these ideas and be active. And for the creative industry, because of copyrights or artists who are afraid that their images got used for training AI and so you can produce images in the style of. There is regulation happening already. There is a great project initiated by Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst, the Spawning platform. And they just released, I think last week, a huge data set that is copyright free. So they really try to change something.
Yeah, and just to explain, Spawning as a platform is an opportunity for artists and creatives to opt out, right? To tell AI systems, I do not consent with my data and visuals being used.
Exactly. Yeah. And these are also things you can already do if you enter the OpenAI platform. You can really opt out there too. Or with another website from Herndon and Dryhurst, you can really check if your images got used for training. So there are already so many tools and they are artists. So it's interesting that artists take over the job of activists.
I think part of that is as well that the stories and the hype around new technologies like AI often make us feel and believe that these are extremely complex technologies that don't even make the effort to try and understand it. I think what Matt Tries and Holly Herndon are very good at is that they demystify it and basically show it's actually not that complicated and you can opt out and you have agency. But all of us probably are in a position that we need to do a little effort than just scrolling and clicking and consuming to actually understand what's going on in order to have that sort of agency to act differently.
That's right, but that should also be a part of education. So governments should really implement more of digital education into the school system, for example. Or teach children how to program. And now programming, it gets easier and easier. It's just like with your common language, you can program now.
Using AI models.
Using AI models. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. So there are a lot of things that are really very great. You just have to get away from this path of fear to the path of hope and create good stuff.
I'm curious about your story as an artist in connection to technology. Did technology or digital technology always play a role in the way you created work and you thought about approaching new artworks? Or was there a certain moment where you started to implement it a little bit more than before?
I think it grew together a little bit more. But I basically started with photography, also in the dark room, like very analog, but already with the opportunity to make analog deepfakes. Like I really liked the idea to combine images after shooting them. So the reflection on the media was always there, just because I was never using a brush or something like that. You always have a technology that somehow outgrows itself. Because when I started, there was analog photography, suddenly there was digital photography, and the same with film. So I couldn't afford real film. I wasn't happy with the quality of digital video. So I found a technique that somehow integrated photographs that were animated. It was always a strategy to get more out of a technological thing. It's very stressful. AI really is the most stressful thing I was ever researching in.
Yeah, why?
Because every week something new is happening. Yeah. And it's not like that. There's some change, but there are fundamental changes that in the beginning, if you have the news, or I still remember the moment when DALL-E was published and suddenly you could prompt a real image with your... Before I was like generating images with training data sets, but that you write a sentence or describe an image and you get the image afterwards. Yeah. It was just insane.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's very common. But that moment, I really was afraid, oh my God, what am I going to do in the future? I produce images. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants images anymore. Mm. I also got sick of images because, yeah, you don't have to make an image anymore. Mm. You just describe it.
Yeah.
And it's there. Mm. And then you not even get one, you get four to select.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was stressful because you felt like you can't even keep up with it. Like you want to, when you're as an artist, you use the technology to create work. But when you feel like every week there's a new update dropping that changes the game completely, it puts you into this stressful. How did you deal with that stress? Or did you, did you develop certain strategies to deal with?
At that point, I was teaching at universities. The part of my lecture was really like, okay, what happened last week? And then we were like looking on the technology together and also talk about or discuss what does that mean for us. It was interesting because also the students, they were quite happy about these tools they suddenly had and not to go to the dark room anymore or even have to manage a camera. But I always try to see it very critical. So also to the bad outcomes who come out of the technology. And we now have these models in autonomous weapon systems with object detection, stuff like that. Yeah, there's always a dark side of this hype.
Just to understand, that means the AI models find a way into weapons and the sensors of weapons that identify certain faces or certain people based on AI models that have been trained on.
Yes.
Yeah.
So OpenAI, that was basically open source some years ago, actually delivers this technology now. And these are things we really should discuss. If a company should be capable of all these things and monopolize the technology so much.
Is there a way to eliminate bias, you think? Because obviously everyone is biased. You, as an artist creating this work, also put in probably certain biases and ideas about representation that maybe not everyone agrees or not everyone feels represented by. So how do you deal with that?
It's totally true. That's always the argument of people when I say, okay, I work with gender bias or bias in AI models. It's always, but it's not a problem that we can solve. But I think we can make systems more fair. And they are not fair yet. So we also try as a society to acknowledge marginalized groups and try to make the system more fair for everyone. I think we should start with AI models as well.
Yeah, I agree. I want to go back to the creative process of creating those images. So you chose hundreds or even thousands of images that you cleaned up, that you scanned, that you found in archives, and you used to train the model. And then you took texts from Freud, Wittgenstein, psychoanalysis to also train it. But how does the model differentiate between visual material and text material? Is it
in this
two
case
different
I used
engines?
It's two different engines. Okay. Now with OpenAI, you have the model that can do both. Mm. But they are probably trained individually and get merged. But I'm not a programmer.
Yeah. So it's two different systems. Mm-hmm. One trained on visual data, one trained on textual data. Yeah. And how did those systems then work together to create the output, the images? Is it almost mm-hmm. like the model is trained on certain theoretical text that influences then how it generates the images, similar to like how a person maybe takes different images that has read Freud or Wittgenstein? Yeah. Is that a
In this case, I used StyleGAN models. That means that if you feed them images, they only produce images. Mm-hmm. So you don't prompt. And with text, it's the same. You implement text, what you get is text.
Okay.
The third AI model, that mm-hmm. was me putting together yeah. image and text mm-hmm. and created these monologue of this face that was fluently changing and speaking about what it is mm-hmm. to be alive.
Okay, then the models that we talked about, what do you use them for? And do you still keep developing them for various projects and output?
Not really. It's also
just nice to have a model.
It's nice to have them. They also change. The systems change yeah. really fast. So for me also the model I used, it was not the best one. It's also the output, because I had not so much training data, the output gets very interesting, but there are a lot of glitches in it. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes very uncanny, so it's not perfect, mm-hmm. which makes it more interesting. I also did a series beside the video. I created Polaroids. Mm-hmm. So I used the images and transferred them on Polaroids. And on the Polaroids, because it's also quite an old technology with expired material, for me it's like, what you see is a picture that includes two dying media. So it's the medium of this old StyleGAN model that collapses with the Polaroid. And mm-hmm. certainly, I'm quite sure that in 10 years, these two systems won't exist anymore because they are just outdated. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of outdated of technology in my yeah. storage, for yeah, yeah, example, yeah. Mm-hmm. that still somehow works, but mm-hmm. can't connect to reality anymore.
I think reality is a great keyword, because how do you think, we touched upon it, but more concretely, how do you think these models create reality in a way? Because obviously I think you can make the point that these models and their biases put out certain things that create things that people take as real and that then shapes their point of view on the world. Was this part of your research, even on a philosophical level, of how reality is created using AI models and AI technologies?
That's a good question. Social media, all these algorithms create really a parallel mm-hmm. reality, like this mirror reality that also Naomi Klein in her new book talks about, so that everybody thinks he or she lives in this reality. Mm-hmm. But it's different for everyone, from everyone to everyone. Mm. And I think it always was. But now with social media algorithms, it's getting more and more different, more diverse. And I think almost everybody in the world has his or her own reality. So that's also because I think why politics go so wrong right now. And it's really hard to think about. If you think about my project, it's also a populist project. Mm-hmm. It's quite simple. Mm-hmm. I don't think that I usually work like that. But it's also like an answer what we see every day on social media. Mm-hmm. That it's getting more and more flat. And also in a democracy, we really have to learn to articulate ourselves more easy. Mm.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting point, because I had that thought as well. I didn't mention it, that now you mention it, it's a populist project. I don't know if I would have used that word, but when I looked at the images online, I thought it's interesting because they work so that everyone understands in a split second what's going on. It's that simple. And I think it's true, you can criticize this sort of approach as flat or as simplistic maybe, but I think you did it on purpose, because it's more likely to reach a lot of people nowadays, because everyone has so little time and so little attention to actually figure something out on their own, that sometimes you need these simple things to draw them in. So what was this on purpose?
Yeah, I mean, there are people who read the news on Instagram. I don't even know how that works because it's just images.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, if I can't explain, or, you know, like, then I try to be very sensitive to other people and explain them, you know, there is a gender bias going on. With this image, it's really quite clear. And in my reality, to be honest, what I see on the news is a world made by men. Hmm. All the politicians that are somehow powerful are white male. So it's, for me, it's really like this, okay, just do it the opposite and see what happens in between. Because you don't even realize it, what's going on. I was never a big fan of politic art, but maybe this is what we need right now. Or more activism in artistic projects. Because the world is really burning. And we won't be here in the next, I don't know.
I think this goes back to the reality question, because I tend to agree with what you said, that I feel like social media and polarization algorithms have allowed a lot of people, including ourselves, to live in their own reality much more, because we don't rely so much more on broadcast media or broadcast institutions that have this one-to-many approach. Everyone lives in their own little bubble, which has many advantages. But also I feel like, yes, it results in that a lot of small groups are fighting for representation and power, because they see the bias much more obvious than before. And so this creates a lot of tension, and we have lost these mechanisms of finding consensus, I feel like. I think you could criticize that consensus previously was made by certain people in power, certain genders, certain perspectives that we had no influence in, and now we have the influence. Everyone feels like we actually have the power to create reality by using models, to create images, to create videos, to create conspiracy theories that reflect our point of view. And the fights that we see and the tension that we see is that all these groups fighting for their version of reality to become true and mainstream.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my take on it.
You're totally true. I also think that there is almost no discussion going on anymore. It's just like blaming everybody to have a different opinion. And I think we also have to accept opinions of people we totally disagree, because this is the democracy, and we are really missing that point. Because a discussion also with this project, I have a lot of discussions, not so much with women, but more with white men that feel like that the project is unfair and why it is not 50-50 and so unbalanced. But for me, it's like if I have in politics 100% men, they get 100% women. If I would have 50% women in the government, I wouldn't do that project.
But I'm curious about this reaction that you just mentioned. So men approach you and say, this is unfair because this isn't true. There weren't all women on this balcony.
That's
why do you do
fake.
That? Okay,
so
it's deep fake. Ah,
it's
okay. So it's classified
deep
fake as deep
fake. And it's misinformation. But as I said, I don't try to change the history. I just try to change the future.
Yeah. I find it interesting that apparently men don't get the point somehow. That they feel disadvantaged, even though they should be more aware. Probably they have been advantaged their whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to blame them or you, just to switch the focus, because I experience the bias. That's why I focus on the bias. Usually, if you're in your comfort zone, you don't get out of it so easily.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's also biased by me. There could also be different people represented. But then it's also just an art project.
That's what it's
and
for.
And that's also the freedom of art, that I won't spend the rest of my life with this project. There will be other projects as well. But these are just comments I give, or it's like mirroring somehow the status quo that's going on. This is also what I can give as an artist.
I think that's a good way to end the conversation for now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Claudia Larcher. You can find out more about her work at claudialarcher.com.
And if you're interested in more context on how artists work with AI, check out episode 25 of this podcast, where I talk to Serpentine's creative AI curator, Eva Jaeger. This is the Culture and Technology Podcast, produced by the Vienna Business Agency. The Vienna Business Agency supports new companies, projects, and products that develop Vienna's creative industries further.